really here today is to talk about why we are still fighting over civil rights. Why is this a question for us? And it's a question that I personally have thought about. It's a question that I know a lot of other people think about.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Today's forum is co-hosted with the University of Virginia's Law School, and I'm delighted to introduce to everyone here who doesn't know him, John Jeffries, who is the dean of the law school and is seated in the back. It's always a pleasure to co-host events with the University of Virginia Law School. Today's guest is Angela Ciccolo. Several weeks ago, I called my colleague and good friend Julian Bond, who is chairman of the NAACP, to ask who on the staff of the NAACP would be best informed on the Gina 6 incident and could also give a Miller Center forum on why that incident has excited such renewed interest on the part of students in the civil rights movement. Mr. Bond suggested, I'm delighted to say, Angela Ciccolo, who was on the ground in Gina, Louisiana, during the demonstrations, and who has been litigating important cases for the NAACP for many years. She is now serving her second tour as general counsel for the NAACP. Julian Bond suggested that she might be especially receptive to an invitation to visit the University of Virginia because her son graduated from here last year and her daughter Danielle is a student here today. So when I call Mrs. Ciccolo to ask her to speak, she quickly accepted. Angela Ciccolo is a graduate of Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and she earned her law degree at Georgetown University's Law Center. She's been a litigator in private practice in Washington and has represented the NAACP as co-counsel in cases challenging election irregularities following the year 2000 election, in protesting the practices of gun dealers and manufacturers, and in attacking discriminatory lending practices that harm African American consumers. She's a member of the Bar of the United States Supreme Court, as well as the District of Columbia and Maryland bars, and she served on the Board of Governors of the DC Trial Lawyers Association. Since joining the staff of the NAACP, she has received that association's highest staff honor for excellence, outstanding service, dedication, and commitment to the mission of the NAACP. Please welcome Angela Ciccolo.
Good morning. How's everybody doing this morning? I am very glad to be here, and I want to thank George Gilliam and the Miller Center of Public Affairs and the University of Virginia for having me here today to talk about something that's very near and dear to my heart. And I'm going to talk somewhat informally because I hope we'll all be family by the time we leave here. And just to express my gratitude at being able to talk about this topic because it's very important to me and very important to so many people. As George said, my daughter is a first-year student here. My son graduated in May, so I always love to come to the University of Virginia. And since they're here today, I promise I wouldn't embarrass them by telling any jokes or singing or anything like that. So I'll try and keep my remarks on topic. And why I'm really here today is to talk about why we are still fighting over civil rights. It is November 12, 2007. Why is this a question for us? And it's a question that I personally have thought about. It's a question that I know a lot of other people think about. And in thinking about this question, I thought the best way to answer it would be to relate it to a place that I had the opportunity to visit earlier this year. And that place has been in the news a lot. It's a place that really isn't any different from just about any small town that one might visit in the South. It's a place, though, that could be located anywhere, and that place is Jena, Louisiana, and I'd like to tell you about it and tell you about how it relates to why we're still fighting about civil rights. And I think there are some lessons to be learned from Jena, and I'd like to share those with you. Now, Jena is such a small town that if you were driving in your car on the highway and you looked down to change the channel on your receiver or your CD player, you'd miss it. That's how small it is. About 3,000 people live there, 750 families. There's a Walmart Supercenter on US 84 on the road to Natchez, Mississippi. There's a Dollar General store across from the McDonald's. About 85% of the population of Jena is white. About 12% is black. And it is a town where people live and die and go about their daily lives. I thought the roads in Jena were particularly interesting. They're small, windy roads. Some of them are paved, some of them are unpaved, some have curbs, some do not. And they lead through neighborhoods where people live. And what I noticed about Jena is black people live in one part of town and white people live in another part of town. But there were other things about Jena that struck me. There's a white barbershop in town, and it does not cut black people's hair. There are two proms at Jena High School. That's the high school in Jena, Jena High. And there are two proms. There's a prom for black students, and there's a prom for white students. And that struck me in 2007. But there are some other things about Jena High School. In the courtyard, there was a tree until very recently, and that tree was a place where white students gathered to sit and discuss. Last year, about a year ago from where we are right now, a black student, a black freshman, asked the principal if he might sit under that tree with his friends. He asked the principal because that tree was commonly reserved for white students. By tradition, it had been a place where whites sat and blacks didn't sit there. And this was just last year, 2006. And so he went with his friends, and they sat and they had a pleasant afternoon. And they felt empowered because they were sitting in a place where they hadn't really sat before. And then the next day something happened, something that has reverberated throughout the country and throughout the news media, because the next day, under that tree, in that tree, were three nooses hanging. And it caused an uproar that we're still talking about today. Now, I speak and travel all over the country, and I found it remarkable that many people do not understand what the noose symbolizes. And for African Americans and people who've lived in the South, the noose has been an unmistakable symbol. It's a symbol of fear. It's a symbol of intimidation. It's a symbol of social control. And it is also a symbol of violence. And as we know, nooses are often related to the phenomena of lynchings. There's an excellent work, if you've read it, it's called Festival of Violence by Stuart Tolney and E.M. Beck. It really traces the history of lynching in America. And in Festival of Violence, they estimate between 1882 and 1930 in the United States, a black man, woman, or child, yes, I said child, was lynched every week without failure between 1880 and 1930. Those lynchings continued every year until 1952 in the United States. And they were a horror and a reminder of subjugation and terror. There's something else, though, that I need to say about lynchings to understand why the nooses in Gina provoked such a reaction. And I think it's important because lynchings were not an isolated phenomenon. They weren't done in secret. They weren't done in the dark of night. There were newspaper advertisements. People would get dressed up and drive for miles around. They would bring their families and friends, and they would take photos and have lunch and wait for a spectacle of killing. The lynching victim often was dismembered, tarred, or feathered, and people who watched the spectacle would take with them a piece of the rope or a piece of the tree or even a piece of the body. And that continued, as I said, without fail every year until 1952. The last recorded lynching, by the way, in the United States was about 1968, although some say that current hate crimes and some crimes might also qualify as a lynching. But one reason lynchings stopped and ceased in the United States was because of civil rights activists and activism. And so for many in the community of Gina, when the nooses appeared, they had a historic memory of those events, and it really touched them and told them that they needed to act. But it is peculiar that the school and the people of Gina who ran those institutions did not act, as would have been thought. I'm sorry to say that the black students were told that they should just put the incident behind them. The students who hung the nooses were never expelled from school. They were never charged with any crime. They weren't really disciplined. And so as the parents in the community felt racial tension boiling in the community, the district attorney came to the school, to Gina High. He brought police officers, and he told the students that he could end their lives with the stroke of a pen. A lot of parents found that very troubling, but it created an atmosphere of tension and unrest. And several weeks later, there was a fight. Some white students beat a black student. Violence in the schools. And the white students, most of them weren't charged. One was charged with a misdemeanor, but he served no jail time. And so all of these events, the nooses, the white tree, the black and white prom, being told to put it behind you and move forward, were all part of an atmosphere that when black students got into a fight with white students, erupted into a phenomenon known as the Gina Six. Because the black students involved in that incident received punishment. They were expelled from school. And it's interesting, most of them are not back in school now, not homeschooled, not alternative school, not any school. They've lost their educational opportunity. But more important, they were charged with aggravated battery, and later those charges were ratcheted up to a second-degree attempted murder. And as a lawyer, one of the things that we always look for is what would be the aggregating factor, what would be the dangerous weapon in that type of charge. And for the young men in the Gina Six, the dangerous weapon was a tennis shoe. The young men were sent to jail. They were given large bail amounts. Many of them could make it. They spent months in jail. One young man, Michael Bell, was tried and convicted as an adult. His conviction was later thrown out by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. They said he shouldn't have been charged as an adult, and that he should have been tried as a juvenile. And so as the young men have been released from jail, as people pondered Gina, grassroots advocates, just like in the past when lynchings were a phenomenon in this country, got together and said, we're going to go and we're going to march and we're going to protest this situation. And in doing that, I think that they brought three lessons to our attention. And I want to talk about those three lessons today, although I think that there are many lessons to be learned from Gina. There are three that really jump out at me, and I'd like to share them with you, because I think they partially answer the question of why we are still fighting over civil rights. The first lesson that I drew from Gina concerned the phenomena of exclusion. Now, when this republic was founded, when this country was founded, we were fighting over ideals and principles, life, liberty, democracy, equality. And as our jurisprudence has evolved, we have enacted rules and laws that protect us against discrimination based on race or sex or national origin in some areas, regarding sexual preference, laws protecting people on the basis of gender, age, disability, all ways that our country has brought us into a common experience, brought us into the fold. And I found it ironic when I was thinking about our history that today, this very day, 232 years ago today, when our country was fighting a revolution, the American Revolution, that General George Washington signed an order prohibiting black soldiers from fighting in the Continental Army. Even though black soldiers had fought Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill, Breed's Hill, and had been participants in the Stamp Act riots, they were excluded. And so this phenomenon of exclusion has been with us from the beginning. Although no longer codified in law, our social traditions often have their roots in discrimination or racism or cultural traditions that keep exclusionary practices alive. And so when people ask me about Gina and ask me what it means to me, I tell them that one of the lessons of Gina is about exclusion, and that as Americans, we need to come together and make sure that we don't exclude others on those bases: race, sex, gender, national origin, religion, disability. We are a diverse people. We've always been a diverse people. We'll always be a diverse people. And even though those things and practices are often against the law, they're still a reality in many places, many small towns, and many large ones as well. So that's my first lesson from Gina, the lesson of exclusion. There are two others that are important to me also, and I think that the second lesson concerns unequal treatment, concerns due process, it concerns basic fairness. And most of that relates to our criminal justice system. There are huge disparities in the criminal justice system. And the thing about Gina that struck so many people was, why did whites engaged in fights not receive the same type of treatment? Why weren't they charged with crimes? Why weren't they sent to jail? Now, I would like to say very clearly that there's no place in our schools, public schools, universities, or otherwise for violence, fights, or threats. But it is clear that in the situation of Gina, where similar incidents did occur, that perhaps other factors came into play that affected decisions made in the prosecution and charging of the young men. Some of the most common questions that I'm asked at forums had to do with why a tennis shoe was considered a dangerous weapon. Why were the noose hangers not charged with some type of crime? Why was Michael Bell charged as an adult? Why did he have an all-white jury? What resources did his lawyer have to defend him? What about the witnesses? And these concerns, as I said, reverberate throughout our country, The University of Wisconsin did a very interesting study in their racial disparities in the Criminal Justice System Justice Project. And they looked at incarceration rates in the United States. They found them to be far outpacing the rest of the world. They found that African Americans are 8 times more likely than whites to be in the criminal justice system, that a third of African American men are under court supervision, that 12% of African men, American men in their 20s to 30s are actually incarcerated. And the implications of those rates, which also increasingly include young women, are astounding for our communities and for the children that are left behind. I spend some other of my work when I do have volunteer time working with an organization called the Innocence Project, the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project here in Virginia, Maryland, and DC. And we often look at the application of the death penalty. And there was a very interesting study done by Raymond Pasternoster in Maryland, and he looked at race and the death penalty. And what he found is that the offender's race really didn't make a difference in the way that a case was handled, but it did make a difference when the race of the victim was white, because the white victim's defendant more likely than not had a substantial chance of receiving the ultimate penalty, and that was the death penalty. So when we look at GINA and disparities, the unequal treatment, we would have to understand we're still fighting over civil rights, because equal acts deserve equal punishment, and there should be equal justice for all. The third lesson that I would like to discuss in terms of GINA is a broader issue. Once again, we're asking the question why we're still fighting for civil rights. Why are we still fighting over this? And I think that, in my opinion, it relates to our government and our governmental institutions. Sometimes our government doesn't live up to its promises. Sometimes it doesn't protect all its people. And when the government does not act or refuses to act through the application of law, it is up to each and every one of us to hold the government accountable, be it by voting, by speaking freely, and in the case of GINA, assembling and marching and making our voices heard. Now, I have talked to a lot of people about being in GINA, and it is different than any other thing that I've ever witnessed in terms of a march or demonstration. And one thing that really struck me was the presence of young people. Young people were spearheading the movement. They were putting the word out on Facebook and MySpace and YouTube. Like I said, no one had ever heard of GINA, Louisiana before. It's a small, small town. But now there are over 3.2 million Google entries alone on GINA, Louisiana, all from young people, grassroots advocates, saying, let's look at this. Let's talk about it. It has sparked a movement where, in particular, young people are looking at our institutions, looking at our practices, and challenging our government to do better, and each one of us to do better. That day, September 20th, crowd estimates are that 60,000 people converged on GINA. They were all, for the most part, wearing black. They had signs, they had banners, but there were people, not just black people, there were white people, there were Asians, there were Hispanics, people of every race and nationality and creed. And you might not have seen that on the news, marching peacefully and demanding change. And as a testament to that activism, to the people who signed petitions, to the people who took their time and effort to travel, there were some changes, there were some responses. there was a second look at what was happening in the community. And I'm very happy to say that those efforts continue as the people of Gina and other communities look and work to make the world a better place and make their world a better place. And I'm not going to lie to you. There are some people who didn't stay in Gina that day. There are a lot of people who said, I'm just getting out of here. And they put police tape across their driveway so people wouldn't even walk on their yard. But the people who did stay behind, they came out on their porches. They offered the marchers water and lemonade. And they joined in solidarity because they believe in our democratic values and they believe in civil rights and they believe that civil rights benefit all people. So when the mainstream media avoids issues like Gina, it's up to the activists, it's up to all of us to stimulate discussion, to demand accountability, and to insist on fairness even when it does not exist. And what it all comes down to is that we are still fighting over civil rights because we have a history of exclusion that persists. We still have unequal treatment and unfairness in many areas. And we also have a government that is not always responsive to our needs and concerns. And it's up to us as citizens to address those and to speak up. And so if anybody asks you why we're still fighting over civil rights in 2007, I hope that you'll remember those lessons from Gina and that you'll tell them about it. Thank you very much.
I would like to ask those who have questions for Angela Ciccolo to meet me in the back of the room and queue up, and we will take every question that we have time to take. I would like to start off by asking a question that really goes back in history. Since the Civil War, repressive measures, either individual like lynchings and other acts of violence, or state the passage of disenfranchising constitutions and laws and other repressive measures have usually followed close on the heels of successes by African Americans, certainly in the South during the 30 or 40 years following the Civil War, as African Americans were elected to local public office and enjoyed some economic success and started to enjoy some real success in education. That's when the Jim Crow laws really flared up. What's going on in the world, what's going on in the country now that has caused this outbreak of violence and of the use of nooses, not just in Gina, but in other places around the country? Why is this happening now?
Well, thank you for that question. I think that a lot of people are asking the same question. Why are we seeing this now? And in my perspective, it's something that we've always seen. It's perhaps that we're more willing to talk about it now and to publicize it than we were in the past. These problems and issues have always been with us as a culture and a society. And when I talked about some of the exclusionary practices, the ones that we're often most familiar with relate to African American slavery and Jim Crow, but there's a whole another litany of exclusionary practices or discriminatory practices, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Page Law, other acts that influence immigration. But many of those influence the right to work and who would be employed. And so I do think that when there are economic pressures, fighting over jobs, the ability to retain a place to live, that we do see more of these types of incidents, and maybe their reaction to pressures that people feel And as an outlet, they take these tactics. But in our structure and in our history, we have, as a people, preferred not to use violence and means of violence as the way to settle disputes. And so I think that it's equally important that when these events do arise, that people do stand up and remind each other that there's another way to handle them that does not involve violence or threats of violence, that we can all get along, we can all live as one, and we can do better than we have.
John Jeffries is the dean of the University of Virginia Law School.
Angela, of all the details that you usefully provided, the one that completely stunned me was the fact that there were two proms. I wonder if you can provide a little background to that, and particularly, do you know whether the high school administrators were complicit in allowing that arrangement to go forward?
Well, thank you. The two-prom phenomenon is something that we've seen a lot about. I see a lot of it in my work. Sometimes we do file cases about a black prom and a white prom, but yes, it was a school-sponsored event, and to put it as simply as possible, the school has decided and the people of the community have decided that whites want to attend one event and black students want to attend another event, and they have fostered that separation and encouraged it by setting up two proms. Now, it would be my preference that all the students attend one prom for cost savings, to get to know each other and to learn from each other. That's what school is about, learning to get along with other people, learning new things, meeting new ideas. And I think that there will be some litigation over that system and other systems that remain like it.
Has the event in Jena reverberated upward, one might say, to Baton Rouge, the legislators, and Louisiana's representatives in Washington? And if so, what reaction has there been?
Well, thank you. Governor Kathleen Blanco was very concerned about what she was seeing in Jena. You know, she's had come under a lot of attack, not only for Hurricane Katrina and what happened, but I think was very moved by the number of citizens that reached out to her about Jena. To her credit, she brought the district attorney in, and I think exerted some pressure there. She had hundreds of thousands of signatures from citizens of Louisiana and all over the country asking for that district attorney to look at what had happened. But it's also reverberating in a different way up through the Justice Department. There were many concerns about why the noose hangers were not charged as a hate crime, and why there was not some action taken against them. And of course, there are some Louisiana statutes that would have been applicable to that activity, the hanging of nooses for the purpose of engendering violence, fear, or threat of violence. And so the Justice Department, in reassessing the situation, will have to, in the future, And as it evaluates current situations, I think take them more seriously and understand historically why they're important, why they engender fear, and why they need to intervene to make a situation better from the get-go and not just let them go. I think that in the future we'll be seeing a lot more activism from the Justice Department's community relations services that help deal with these types of issues. So we are seeing activity. It's going to take some time, but the continued pressure is what is making the difference.
My name is Janet Morrow, and I note that you worked on election irregularities following the election in Florida. On 2000, there are lots of us who think there were irregularities in Ohio in 2004. And I wonder if you could make any predictions of what we're likely to see in 2008, whether there have been any remedies or any positives or negatives that you can see that we kind of foretell what's going to happen then?
Thank you. That's a very interesting question. Well, we'll have a presidential election in 2008. There are activists all over the country looking at policies and procedures affecting elections, everything from photo identification to how registrations occur or who will be allowed to register voters. And all of those things have implications for our elections, of course. I think that what we're going to see is more private groups acting as private attorney generals, such as my organization, the NAACP. I think you'll see the League of Women Voters and other organizations paying a very close look at how elections are being handled and administered. And the reason for the private activism is, just as I said with Gina, many people do not see the government taking these issues seriously, acting and working to enforce the rights of the voters. And so my prediction is you'll see more private activism, more people pulling together in groups to come up with a solution.
Several years ago, I remember reading an editorial in the Christian Science Monitor about the tremendous amount of racism that was still going on in the South. And I responded to that by saying that I felt that there was a great deal I feel it in this community anyhow, that there's a great deal of more understanding between whites and blacks in the South than there ever was before. And that in many cases, there are greater cases of discrimination taking place in the North. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think that's an excellent point and a point very well taken, because as I said at the very beginning, Gina is not just about this small Louisiana town. It's a phenomenon that is occurring all over the country. I think it's interesting that some of the recent news hangings we've seen have been at the University of Maryland, at Columbia University, at the Coast Guard Academy, on Long Island, New York. And you're right, they're not isolated efforts in the South. They are all over this country. And it reminds us, and it reminds me, that as Americans, we should remember that civil rights do protect all people. When we protect the rights of those that are disenfranchised or discriminated against, we really do work to make it a better country for all of us. And so we're encouraging activists all over the country, New York, the Southwest, to work together and put an end to those practices wherever they occur.
It has been 42 years since the last major piece of civil rights legislation was enacted by the Congress. What's on your legislative wish list now, and what do you think are the prospects for more significant civil rights legislation?
I think that the future is bright, but I think that at this juncture, it's important for Americans and for our legislature to recognize that the civil rights laws that have been enacted should be retained and enforced. My biggest concern at this juncture is enforcement of the laws that we already have, which in many areas is sorely lacking. And so if I were going to have Congress listen to me, I would want better enforcement of our existing laws, for them to be strengthened and to really be enforced for all people.
Has the focus on the war on terror diverted Justice Department resources away from enforcement of civil rights laws?
Well, I believe it certainly has. Certainly our Justice Department is, and I think credibly and rightfully, concerned with international issues, domestic and international terrorism. I'm sure you hear more about the Patriot Act and the Keep Protect America Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, then you hear about GINA. That's what the mainstream media talks about. It's important for us all to look at those issues, too, because they do have implications for privacy, our right to privacy, how our records might be searched, seized, or reviewed. And they have wide implications. We would like to see more Justice Department resources focused on civil rights issues because, as I said, we believe that that is the foundation of a strong democracy for all of us.
I was wondering if you have heard anything about what happened. Have they found yet the people who burned the school building?
Actually, I don't know very much about that. I know that there are efforts to try and identify those persons, but I don't have any new information.
My name is Marcus Ingram, and I'm a doctoral intern here at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. This will probably end up being more of a personal question, but it's couched in some theory that I believe that you are familiar with. I consider myself to be a hopeful person, but I encountered Derrick Bell's critical race theory recently, and one of his contentions is that racism will always exist. When I read that, he then began to talk a little bit more about if that's the case, then why he continues his studies as a legal scholar. So, with that context, would you explain to us or share with us whether or not you agree with that contention that racism will always exist in America? And depending on what that response is, would you tell us what it is that compels you on a daily basis to show up for the struggle?
Thank you. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thought and a wonderful question. Will it always exist? Well, it has always existed from the get-go, from our inception. It's part of our very core. There's always been a tension between public policy, our institutions, our aspirations as a society, and the reality of racism. That's just the way it's been. It's always been that way. Now, have things gotten better? Yes, they have. They most certainly have gotten better, and I know that in my own lifetime, I've seen advances that I never would have thought possible, and that my parents never would have thought possible, so I'm hopeful. In reality, do people see each other's differences when they meet them? Yes, they do. But I think that our differences are good. I think they're valuable. I think they make us stronger. I think we can learn from each other and grow and build on that. So I will always be a glass half full person moving forward and hoping that we can all work together and build bridges and build strengths, because it really does make us better. And this is not the time to fight with each other.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a resident of Charlottesville, and my question relates to felonies. Is there any action on the part of the NAACP to encourage the state of Virginia and I think maybe one other state that has the law that, well, someone that commits a felony really has to go through a process to have their voting rights reinstated? Are there any movements by the NAACP to have this done away with? Secondly, at the high school, in the locality that you spoke of, what's the atmosphere and is the isolation within that school, or did you have an opportunity to observe that?
Sure, thank you. The issue about felons is very interesting to me. We do have a prison project that works on those issues. Being a felon has so many issues related to it. Not only in many states do you lose the right to vote, but you can lose the right to get educational loans. You can lose the right to live in some public housing. You can lose the right for some governmental licenses. You can lose the right to serve on a jury, and on and on and on. And we've compared felon felons and the incidence of a felony conviction to a middle passage, because it really does take the person who served time and put them in a status where they lose many of the incidents of citizenship, as you said, the right to vote, the right to serve on a jury, et cetera. In my scheme of living, rehabilitation and reintegration into society is very important. I believe that people who've served their time need to be incorporated into society and to have the opportunity to contribute and be productive members of society. I think restoring the right to vote does encourage a person to participate in government and to give a voice. And those types of activities would be the types of activities my organization would be emphasizing. And I think that's a very, very important phenomenon that you've raised about the rights of felons. You also asked me about the high school, and I'm sorry, I'm getting a little older here, and I think you did ask me about the high school, but there's still tension at the high school. And unfortunately, for the school administrators, they have not taken, I think, all the steps they could to make the students aware that they are a community and that they need to come together. There have been some probably less than well-meaning adults who have helped fan the flames on both sides of the aisle. And there's a lot of work to be done in that community. But I think it's the young people who have the heart for change, maybe not the some of the older folks, but it's the young people who want their community to have a positive face and a positive future.
Hi, I'm Risa Golubov. I teach here at the law school. And my question is kind of a follow-up to Marcus's. And that is, there seems like there's a tension between wanting to think about these kinds of incidents as aberrations and wanting to think that the people who engage in this kind of conduct are different from most Americans. And then there's, on the other hand, the reality that they're cropping up all over the place and that this happens relatively frequently and that governmental officials, a lot of whom are elected, don't seem to be responsive, which may suggest then that a lot of people don't want there to be a response. And trying to decide between something being pervasive and something being aberrational, I think, is really important in terms of how you then address it. And so I'm curious which one you think it is. You're obviously optimistic, but it's a different thing to say these are manifestations of the kind of racism that Derek Bell writes about that's everywhere, and the exclusion that goes on in the proms or under the tree is a manifestation of widespread feelings among whites that lead to exclusion, and saying, no, most people really do get along, most people really are well-meaning, and it's just a few bad apples. So I'm just curious which one you think it is, and then what role law plays in fixing whichever one of those two problems you think you see.
Wow. I could really talk to you about that all day. I think there's so many different facets of both of your questions that intrigue me as an attorney, but also as an advocate. Sometimes I think what we see depends on where we stand and what we hear. For the person experiencing acts of racism, discrimination, exclusion, it's a painful daily assault on your dignity and character. It can occur anywhere from a police stop. I've been stopped so many times. I almost keep a notebook of where I've been stopped. And I do tell some young men to keep a notebook, because they get stopped so often. Our media talks about what's important, but it doesn't always talk about what's happening. These issues are there every day in so many communities. I don't know how we get a brighter, wider focus on them, except for as individuals, putting our focus on them and, I don't know, taking control of the media. I think that in terms of our jurisprudence, we have come a long way in establishing cases, laws that say these practices are wrong. Discriminatory practices, race, sex, national origin, and more. More today, we're seeing more rights and expansion of rights. For example, in the area of sexual preference, we're seeing more of those types of laws and regulations and more expansion. So I think that the laws are there, but I think that the tension that I see is rooted in our traditions and our culture, our expectations, and our interaction with each other. The reason your question is I think, an interesting one is that I think there are different answers probably for different communities with different experiences. And like I said, I think we're going to have to continue that dialogue, but I am very hopeful. But I go back to the area of enforcement. Because, as I said, even though those laws have been put on the books, even though they exist, it is in the schizophrenia, I would say, of decisions on the area of employment law, for example, that cause legal practitioners who represent individuals who say they've been discriminated against causes fear, causes anger, causes angst. I think that we have a long way to go to ensure enforcement is equal, and that's where I would look at this point. But I think you need to write another book on that question itself, and I'll buy a copy of certain too.
Thank you. It seems to me that the noose is a clear metaphor for the sedimentations of history that rear their ugly heads, so to speak, now and then. Deep at the heart of this question is the anxiety that blood must not mix, hence the need for two prompts and the anxiety surrounding what black men and white women will do if they get too intimate. Are there any conversations in the Jaina community that can foster extrajuridical conversations about the resolution of these issues? Because it seems to me that you can't use the enforcement of laws alone to deal with these complex issues.
Thank you. In response to what you've described, that tension and those fears, there are some that have offered to go to Jaina to conduct, and the only way I could describe it would be community counseling and reconciliation. For example, the Harvard Civil Rights Project has agreed to go down and try to work with the community to bridge some of those gaps. You reminded me of a very interesting book by James Lowen. It's called Sundown Towns. I don't know if you've read it, but it's about a phenomenon where there were towns all over the country where after a certain time of day, African Americans did not stay in the town. You left because there were serious consequences, threats of death. If you haven't read it, it's an excellent issue. And James Lowen discusses that phenomenon and how we can address it together. And it does come down to individual education, individual commitment, and a recognition that we are all in the same boat together. Those are the things that make a difference. Those are the things that bridge gaps. And although the laws remain on the books and should be enforced, it's often the cultural, economic, social, and political motivation that will affect the outcome of those types of questions.
Hi, I'm Gian McKee. I'm a historian here at the Miller Center. And One of the developments in scholarship on civil rights and the history of race in the last decade or so has been a push to look at what one historian has called the long civil rights movement, breaking down the old boundaries of Montgomery to Memphis, or even earlier, the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, and to look at the long stretch of activism around racial and civil rights issues before and after that kind of classical phase. And I'm wondering if you can put the GINA situation in more of that context, the long civil rights. What is GINA's history in terms of civil rights, the civil rights movement and activism, and even its social and economic structure looking over a long time period? You mentioned the pressure that economic change itself can put on race relations. Is there anything in that area in particular that you see in the sort of deep background to the GINA 6 situation?
Well, GINA is an interesting place, but like I said, it's not really different than a lot of other communities. In me and my research about GINA, the most interesting thing I found was that it had a female sheriff very early on in its history, which I thought was extraordinary, that a woman would have such a position in such a town. Arguably, the civil rights movement continues. I think it continues. I think that when we take artificial time limits and say this is the end of the civil rights era, this is a new era, we fool ourselves, because I believe that our history shows a whole litany of progression of civil rights, progression of the expansion of rights, and that we're on a continuum. Part of that's related to what I see as a Western notion of time, where events stop and start. And I think we have to view civil rights and civil liberties more as more fluid, that events have affected history and that they reverberate. We're seeing reverberations of that movement, Montgomery. But I know from my work that I see many things that I expected never to see again. I have probably 400 letters on my desk right now of events or circumstances that I thought didn't happen anymore, but they are happening. They're happening in different ways. They're maybe more subtle, they're more sophisticated, but in many ways it's the same old racism, the same old discrimination packaged up with a new exterior. I think the solutions are going to come from within, from the individuals, from scholarship, from honest discussion, from working together, and I remain hopeful. So we're on a continuum. I see it just being a little bit different.
In previous political years, there have been loud voices, sharp voices on behalf of African American concerns. Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and others. This year, with Barack Obama, who speaks with a much quieter and more moderate voice, how does this change the discourse over civil rights? And do you think it will advance concern about civil rights, or do you think it'll keep them in check?
I think that it will advance civil rights, and here's why I think that. I think that many people are fighting for equal justice, equal opportunity. I don't think we have to all do it the same way, though. I don't think we have the same talents. I don't think we reach the same audience. I think what's important is that we stay on message, that we stay on a course for justice and for equality. And people have different ways of articulating. They have different audiences they want to reach. But I think it's important, even if we're all working maybe in slightly different areas, that we're all working toward the same common goal. And that's what I see. I think it's wonderful that we have viable African-American candidates, viable women candidates for the office of President of the United States, because that diversity in the highest office of our land can only lead to an enriched meaning of what I think it means to be an American and what it means to live in a culture of progress, change, and opportunity.
Thank you very much, Angela Ciccola.